With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got all the essentials for comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style you can count on. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and effortless looks. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Out the First. It's Friday, November 10th. I'm Ryan Ballengee. It's good to have you here with us. You can get a hold of me on Twitter or X or Threads or Instagram at the handle Ryan Ballengee. That would also be helpful for Golf Digest social team to know because they didn't tag me and stole my content verbatim and posted it to their social channels last night. I learned about that via text message from a friend in the industry, so that was exciting. Meanwhile, we're presented by our friends at Swannies Golf. Check them out at swannies.co. Fall is here. Winter is close. It's not a great day today to play golf after basically summer three here in the D.C. area, but Swannies has got me covered. Hoodies, quarter zips, pullovers, all kinds of different layers for weather. In addition to their great, their polos are awesome. Great t-shirts, hoodie t-shirts, all kinds of great stuff. Use the promo code GolfNewsNet25. Save 25% on your first order at Swannies.co. That's GolfNewsNet25 is the promo code. All right, so today I want to talk about a couple of different things. One, it's a little wonky, but I think it's worth knowing about, and that is changes that will be made to the World Handicap System in 2024. So they'll go into effect on January 1st. This email went out a couple of days ago, and I hadn't written an article about it, and the changes actually are quite interesting. So if you'll recall, the RNA and the USGA got together and created this World Handicap System concept that came out a couple of years ago. And the idea was to have taken these two somewhat disparate systems, bring them together, and let everybody kind of play under the same banner. And they changed the counting score system from 8 scores out of your last 20. So your handicap could swing a little bit more dramatically. And mine has at times. I mean, I could go and play a good round and my handicap changes by a full shot. And that didn't used to happen in the old system. You used to have to kind of grind it out to really make substantive change in your handicap index. And that's no longer true, but there are also some great benefits because it's easier to post. 9-hole rounds are encouraged as part of the system. They have the playing conditions calculations that can adjust how your score that day rates compared to other days because of weather or other conditions. There's some benefits. It's good. I like the new system, even though it probably rates me as having better golf talent than I actually have. And they've made some changes. The first significant updates since the introduction of the system in January 2020, before the world shut down. And the governing bodies of golf kind of like to make changes to these types of things every 4 years. They do it for the rules of golf. They make changes every 4 years. So it sounds like they're going to do it for this as well. And there are 125 countries around the world that use this World Handicap System, even though there are like 220 countries around the world. Not everywhere's got a golf course. Not everyone plays golf. So effectively, everybody's using the system. So here are the changes for 2024. First one is that there's going to be an inclusion of shorter length golf courses in the course rating system, which I think is great. So the requirement to be a golf course that can count to have a course rating and a slope rating is now changed. So an 18-hole course can be as short as 1,500 yards or 1,370 meters to be eligible. And a set of tees on a 9-hole course can be as short as half that, 750 yards or 685 meters. And the idea is to allow more people to have a handicap. That was part of this whole thing, was that we wanted to create a system the governing bodies wanted to create a system where they could foster more people to have a handicap index. Because something like 15% of golfers in this country have a handicap, which means the overwhelming number of people don't. And that's not necessarily because they're not good at golf. It might be because they're a public golfer and they don't really see the need to have a handicap index. They just play the game for fun and it doesn't matter to them what their index is. They may do it through manual means. You may have your own spreadsheet. You go, okay, well, you know, here's my rating slope and all that stuff, and do the calculation yourself. I don't think there are a lot of people that do that, but I think that's a possibility. And also, there are just some people that are new to golf, and they don't even know what a handicap is, and they don't see the value in putting in scores if they haven't really improved enough yet. I think a lot of people see having a handicap as something good golfers have, and that's not true. I don't think that's true whatsoever, but that's kind of the stigma. So part of this is trying to say, okay, a lot of people are starting to kind of favor playing shorter form golf, whether that's 6 holes or 12 holes or 9 holes, whether that's a short course, maybe it's an executive course. Those things have really kind of come back in vogue, which has been great. And so those things have been largely left out of the world handicap system. Now they're changing that. So they're going to make those types of courses eligible for course and slope rating, which means if you just go play, you know, I grew up playing short little par three courses in Severna Park, Maryland, and Odenton, Maryland, Crofton, Maryland. Those places were great, and now they can be rated. And they helped me learn golf, and hopefully that can get people into the handicap system, maybe start thinking about playing competitive golf, whether that's within your peer group, whether that's at that facility, bigger competition. You know, that's a good thing. The second big change is that they're going to make this playing calculation, conditions calculation adjustment more frequent. So this was invented so that you could adjust the course and slope rating that day for abnormal playing conditions. And typically that meant nasty weather, like really windy or really dry or those types of things. And national associations had discretion to introduce revisions to how this worked, and they will be ready by April of next year. So they might say, okay, we punched the greens. That's going to change how the course plays. Or, you know, we're doing work on X, Y, and Z. This hole's a temp tee. This hole's a temp green. They can make those kinds of changes on the fly starting next April. I think that's a good thing. I would like for it to be used more often, even if it's just a little bit, because I think playing in really difficult conditions, it can be hard for a lot of people. If you have a great round that day and the course or facility or whatever that's making these adjustments doesn't do it, you don't get credit for it. So hopefully there's some encouragement to do that a little bit more often. And then the third big change that will affect the most people, the last one affects fewer people, but the third change that affects the most people is using an expected score for a hole not played. So to explain that, when you play a 9 or 18 hole round and you can't finish. So a 9 hole round, you're supposed to put, if you play 5 holes, that can count toward a 9 hole score. And then you would use your existing handicap index and the numbers of handicap holes on that remaining number of holes to determine what your expected score would be. So if you were getting a pop there, you expect a bogey kind of thing. If you were expecting no strokes, then you would expect a par. If you were for some reason going to add one, you would expect a birdie. And that would be how you would compute the rest of your score for your 9 or 18 hole round. 18 hole round, I believe you have to play 13 holes. Don't hold me to that, but I'm pretty sure that's it. So they have now changed the system so that improvements have been made to how to handle holes when they're not played, which will now be based on a player's expected score rather than a score of net par. So that whole thing of, hey, if you were getting a pop on that hole, then your net par would be coming from a bogey, right? Because if you got one and you were playing a par 4, you'd make a 5 to get net 4. So now they're going to change that a little bit. And it says the new method will produce a 9-hole or 18-hole score differential that more accurately reflects a player's ability. And it says as golfers across the world play more 9-hole rounds, and I'm one of those people, play a lot more 9-hole rounds in the last 5 years, an expected score can be also used to convert a 9-hole round into an 18-hole score differential. So that means you'll be able to take your 9-hole score and it'll affect your handicap the next day. So it'll count as though it was an 18-hole score. And that will mean you can go and play a 9-hole round of golf, help your handicap or hurt it, affect it in some fashion, but they won't go, okay, well, we're waiting to combine that nine-hole score with another nine-hole score. I think this is a great thing. I think this is the biggest change and, frankly, the most important to people who play golf like I do. So I'm most invested in this. And the reason I'm most invested in it is because my handicap can get adversely affected for the worse if I have a good nine holes. So if I went and played, I play a lot of nine-hole golf, yes. And I will go play a nine-hole round, and I could have a great score. I could shoot one or two under par because I didn't have to play that much golf. The way that my golf course is set up, we have two par fives on the front and one on the back. So I've got one more crack at making a fairly easy birdie compared to the other holes. So I could get a better score on the front and never have to play the back. And if I play it twice, that means I got a double good score compared to playing the back, which is harder at our club. And that's going to negatively affect what the world handicap system thinks of my score or my capability. So now what they can do is they can take it on a hole-by-hole basis. So they'll have you enter scores hole-by-hole in this scenario. And then they will say, okay, here's the rest of your partial round, how that would have played out all the way through 18 holes. And then that way you get a more accurate representation of what you would do. Because if I go and play a nine-hole round and they backfill with another nine-hole round, well, I didn't get tired, did I? I usually walk when I play. So if I walk and I play nine very well, I'm still fresh. What can happen to me and most golfers is you get tired along the way. Eventually you get to 15, 16, 17. Our course is very hilly, a lot of up and down to traverse. So you get toward 13 is a walk straight uphill on a par three. 16 is a walk straight uphill and you're going down and up, down and up. 18 straight uphill. They can be difficult holes to walk. And I think they're a little bit more taxing after playing a whole bunch of holes before that. So my expected score, if I were going to play 18 holes, I would expect to play definitely not better and typically worse on the back, even though there are several holes, I'd say three or four, that are pretty easy, but the other five are pretty tricky. So I need an expected 18-hole score that reflects the reality that I probably tire out, which probably makes my handicap a little bit less indicative of my skill level. So I think this is a great change. It's a good one. And then the other one, I think this will affect relatively few people. This is kind of a private club thing, but the bullet point is enhanced guidance on conducting a handicap review. And the talking point says the role of the handicap committee at a club is vital to the success of the world handicap system, and the rules recommend that a handicap review is conducted regularly, at least once a year, to ensure a handicap index remains reflective of a player's ability. New reporting tools have been developed that national associations can incorporate into their handicapping software to assist committees in conducting the review. So basically, they just want to try to prevent sandbagging, classic sandbagging, and maybe even reverse sandbagging. I don't know if that really matters to people. Reverse sandbagging, for those of you who don't know, is also known as a vanity handicap, where you kind of only put in your good scores. You don't put in the bad ones, so it doesn't even it out. And you have a handicap that's lower than you are. You go, oh, well, I'm a four. And then you go out there and you shoot like an 85. And they're like, well, you just had a bad day. That's because you didn't enter your 10 scores of 84. So I don't know if they're going to try to do that, but we have that at our club. And they go, oh, we have a committee that reviews all this stuff. Well, they don't. I mean, I could just put in, I shot 62 every day, and I don't think anyone would know the difference. That doesn't really matter because I don't play in competitions that much. But it does. It is, I guess, somewhat important to have an honest handicap, but there are a lot of ways to fudge the handicap system, as I've learned over the years, playing against people who are supposedly significantly worse than I am, and then they trounce me because they're getting so many strokes. So, it's a nice talking point, but it's not really a substantial change. But overall, I like the changes. I think it's good. This is a better system, and it's nice to see them continuing to improve upon it as we go through this kind of first four-year window of it. We'll go and take a break. We'll be back right after this, after a word from our sponsor. If you're like me, you've wanted to buy gold for years. Lots of commercials out there, but who can you really trust? I don't want a bad investment, but didn't want to miss the boat either. Sound familiar? Fortunately, I've got great news. If you have an IRA or 401k and want to buy physical gold, eliminate fear and uncertainty from the process using the new Gold IRA Company Integrity Checklist. It helps you evaluate and choose the best gold IRA company. I used it personally to vet Augusta Precious Metals, and they are absolutely phenomenal. Use this checklist to choose the best gold IRA company. Text to get your free Gold IRA Company Integrity Checklist today. Text GOLF to 68592. Again, text GOLF to 68592. That's GOLF to 68592. Or go to AugustaPreciousMetals.com. Welcome back to the show. It's our second story for today and the end of the week. Also, it's Veterans Day today. And I wanted to, I think I mentioned this in our last show, but I want to say thank you to the people who serve our country here in the United States and serve abroad in other countries. We have an international audience, and a lot of people spend their life in service of their country, of their community, of people, whether that's in the military, which we're talking about here today in Veterans Day, or whether that's being a first responder or a teacher, or there are lots of people contribute big to their communities every day, and that's not lost on me. And I'm very appreciative of those people, especially as someone who has a job that I feel personally doesn't contribute jack squat to society. My job is to talk about a leisure sport that's predominantly played by wealthy people. So, you know, my societal contribution is not that large. And the people who decide they want to be a part of something bigger than themselves and help their country, help their community are special in my view. So thank you, not only to veterans, but just people who do that kind of selfless work. I appreciate it. Okay, I want to talk about the last and final TGL team. I don't think we talked about this. It's been out for a couple of days. Again, I kind of skipped the show earlier in the week because I put one out at like 4 in the afternoon and I didn't want to hit you twice with a show in like 12 hours or 16 hours. So I kind of skipped a day. So we didn't talk about this. And I think it's at least relevant to talk about it. So the final TGL team, the identity, the location of it, the ownership group behind it was unknown. And the folks at Shotgun Start had said they had seen an investment deck that suggested they were trying to target a franchise that would be based in Chicago or with an ownership group that has Chicago roots. Because obviously there is no franchise, you know, you're not playing in a venue in those towns, right? Like Boston, San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles. None of those have venues, right? And they might someday, but they don't now. And they're going to play out of West Palm Beach, Florida at Palm Beach State College. And that's totally fine. But there's no obvious community connection unless you have kind of activation type events in the community, whether you have like golf clinics or outings or things like that. And I think some of that will come along. But they were looking for a sixth city. I think they were thinking Chicago based on this deck that was out there from the Shotgun Start people that mentioned it. I had not seen it, so I'm taking them for their good word. But I think that would have been an important city. Chicago is a great golf city. It's obviously one of the biggest population centers in our country. And indoor golf would kind of resonate in Chicago because they don't have a very full golf season, right? I mean, between them and like Detroit and the state of Michigan, state of Minnesota, state of Wisconsin, state of Illinois. I mean, those are big golf states. Michigan's probably the biggest of them. And they don't have a very long golf season. There are more golf courses per capita in Michigan than I think anywhere in the country or something like that, or per golfer, whatever it is. But there's a metric where you're like, I can't believe there's that much golf in Michigan. But there is. So it would have been cool to kind of have a Midwest tie. But instead, they couldn't pull that together for whatever reason. And so the first team, or the last team, I should say, is the TGL team that will represent Jupiter, Florida. So you've got five huge American cities and Jupiter, Florida. And that sixth team is Jupiter Lynx. And that team is owned by TGR Ventures, so Tiger Woods' team. His company, he does a bunch of different companies, but now they all start with TGR, whether that's his foundation or his tournament management company, different side stuff, you know, that He owns that. And then a guy named David Blitzer, who his he's like a principal at a capital venture firm, but also is one of the guys behind the ownership group of the New Jersey Devils and I think big into the Philadelphia 76ers. So, you know, very wealthy guy. Well, two very wealthy guys, but one very wealthy guy with sports ownership ties outside of golf, and then obviously Tiger Woods. So that's the sixth team. Obviously, Tiger's going to play for his own team, and I'm fine with that. It doesn't really matter unless you're going to go and do tremendous amounts of outreach in the community, and I can't have an expectation about that because this is the first season for TGL, first of all. There aren't other venues to do this. The players who are going to be competing, all 24, they all have worldwide schedules. They're not going back to Boston or San Francisco or, you know, name your city after their weekly games and hanging out like they did if you were a quarterback in the NFL in the 1960s and you bagged groceries on the weekdays, you know, those types of things. So I'm okay with this. It doesn't matter. And Alexis Ohanian, who is one of the co-founders of Reddit, and he's one of the co-owners of the Los Angeles team, along with Serena and Venus Williams, mentioned this, and I will recommend this as well. Wired did a really interesting article on the technology behind TGL and how it's all coming together and who owns what and what they're hoping for. It's a very good piece. I would strongly recommend you read it. It's the first time I've ever seen anything kind of in-depth about TGL in terms of technology, what it'll look like, what it'll feel like, and also some good background information on the ownership structure, who owns what, how it all came together. It's good. And Tiger and Rory, as part of Tomorrow Sports, have the majority stake in this concept. So between Mike McCarley, who's the former Golf Channel president, and Tiger and Rory, they have something like 18% ownership each if they split it evenly. Who knows if they did that? And then Tiger has an ownership stake, and an ownership, team ownership also gets ownership in the league. PGA Tour also has a chunk. I think it's like 17 or 18%. It's not a huge percentage, but that was to sanction it, which they got theirs. So in the end, Tiger's going to own something like, I'm guessing, like 30% of this thing by himself, which that makes sense. I mean, you started the thing. You were involved with it. You put your name on it. So that all kind of adds up. It is interesting to me that Tiger owns at least part of a team, but Rory doesn't, or at least it doesn't. It's not out there publicly. I mean, he may have some part of this with the Boston Common team that he has because they have also signed an agreement with Golf Channel and Golf Pass for content, which is no surprise because, again, Rory McIlroy has a business relationship with Golf Channel and Golf Pass. So that was almost a given that that was going to happen in some fashion. Might not happen for every other team, but it's going to happen for McIlroy's because he, again, is affiliated with them. So it's interesting to me to see the relationships, not only in terms of percentage ownership, etc., but how you go about bringing in your existing relationships to a new relationship. And this is something I've learned in business the last really year, especially maybe 2 years, where trying to build, you know, GNN Radio or GNN TV, and been fortunate to work with some wonderful people, and some of that has been an opportunity just to, with friends, to go, hey, I know someone who would love to work with you on this, and, you know, kind of bring into a network. And it happens in with the people I'm working with on this project too. Oh, I know so-and-so, they'd love to be involved. I know such and such, you know, they might want to invest, and I've never done any of those types of things. It's really fascinating the networking that happens to then make something from an idea to something much larger. And all of a sudden, you've got, in TGL, a lot of really important people, wealthy people, well-known people, culturally important people that are involved, and they all get intertwined very quickly because of their existing relationships as well. And so, if you go read the Wire piece, you'll feel how you feel about TGL. You'll say whether I think this is going to be terrible, I'm going to really like it, I'll wait and see, whatever it is. That's up to you. But I would underscore from a business standpoint that it doesn't take a lot of success to be able to get a large valuation, and that a lot of people can make a lot of money in an environment where a lot of people are looking for sports media rights. I'm one of them looking for sports media rights. I'm looking for opportunities to air golf tournaments. So for the TGL folks, maybe they turn to the example of the National Women's Soccer League, that they just signed a new 4-year media rights agreement. It has a bunch of different partners in it. You don't have to know anything about the National Women's Soccer League other than basically before the pandemic, the league had kind of like shut down before. It wasn't in a good spot. After the pandemic, shutdown stuff happened. It came back with a vengeance. They signed good TV deals to get on network TV and more accessible places to watch their games because people wanted content. And people started watching. It started picking up some steam. People would go in person. They had a playoff game this year where I think it was in San Diego. They had 32,000 people show up. That was their attendance record. So people are starting to latch on to soccer in different ways, and people are starting to latch on to women's sports in different ways. Volleyball's been huge for women's sports. I mean, it's growing at a crazy pace. But all that to say, the National Women's Soccer League 4-year deal is worth $240 million. They're getting $60 million a year in rights. And that might not sound like that much compared to NBA rights or NFL rights or MLB rights, those types of things. But their previous deal was for $1.5 million a year. So they have increased their deal 40-fold. And they have set themselves up so that their next contract will come due right around the time of the Women's World Cup, the next one. And they hope that will mean a substantial increase. So for TGL, if they can demonstrate a significant audience, they can go from fledgling concept, and who knows how it'll be received, to extremely wealthy concept in very little time. And that's the gamble of this league. And I understand that they want to reach more people and all this stuff, but everything in the end comes back to dollars, comes back to what you make off of what you do. And they are putting their names on this thing in hope that all of their collective influence, money, cultural, whatever, will lead to people embracing this, and that will lead to expansion and more money, and that's how it works. So it's a very interesting article, Wired. I strongly recommend you check it out, but think of it through that view, and then you'll kind of understand a little bit more about, I think, how TGL works and why it could or could not work. That's going to do it for us today on the show. Thank you for spending time with us today and this week. I really appreciate it. It's always fun doing the show. I like getting to talk about these stories really quickly with you because it just makes my day go a little bit quicker and hopefully yours as well. You can find me on Twitter, Threads, X, and Instagram. I'm at the handle Ryan Ballingy. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. I appreciate any conversation you want to have, especially if you want to talk golf or life and, you know, are generally polite. Some people aren't, but that happens sometimes. We'll be back next week with another slate of shows. We'll go over the results from all the major tournaments. We'll have one final PGA Tour event to sew up, the FedEx Cup fall. We'll talk about the implications of that and some other things that are sure to come up as the DP World Tour season comes to a conclusion and the LPGA Tour season comes to a conclusion next week as well. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week on Two Off the First.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at FreeStyleLibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us.